Hello, it's Tuesday 28th of July. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bauerman from Check-in Asia.
Today, we rewind through 7 months of living, working and podcasting in a COVID-19 bubble.
Yes, with little sign of movement on border reopenings, we reflect on 7 lost months in travel and tourism. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So, as we approach the start of August, the ongoing impact of the coronavirus shows no sign of stopping. We're about to enter the 8th month of this crisis, during which time we've produced 30 podcasts, including this one.
Yeah, so to mark our 30th anniversary, we're going to revisit the format of our pilot show way back in December 2019. That seems like almost another lifetime. And we're going to interview each other on some of the critical events, milestones, insights, and outcomes from the past 7 months. So, Hannah, I'm going to put you on the spot first of all with a gentle intro question.
Sure.
When did the alarm bell start to ring this year for you about the potential impact of COVID-19?
Well, I remember still travelling in January. I went to Bangkok, and I think it was vaguely on my mind then because I do remember there being Chinese tourists at Dong Mueang Airport when I was coming home and thinking, oh, maybe I'd better be a little bit more careful around this duty-free. But I don't think it was really until February when I visited Singapore on a sales call and actually spent a lot of time even debating whether I should travel to Singapore. And that was just after Chinese New Year, so I think mid-February. And when I was there, already the impact was really apparent on these Singaporean travel agents. You know, half of their desks were empty. People were already on leave back in February. And I think that's when I really realized, you know, things are getting serious. How about you?
Well, right from the beginning, I'd have to say, I mean, I remember being in the UK right at the end of December when the first cases of suspected pneumonia at the time in Wuhan were announced on the TV. And I must admit, my stomach sort of dropped at that point. Having arrived in China many, many years ago, just after SARS, I suddenly got this horrible feeling. But as you say, you know, we went through January, we were both traveling. I was traveling as well.
Yeah.
And I also went down to Singapore at the end of February, did an event down there, a coronavirus and economics event with an epidemic specialist.
Yes.
And I remember his words that, you know, this coronavirus is the perfect virus for transmitting. He looked at the structure of the virus and the way that it actually transmits between people. And at that point, you could see, as you said, in Singapore, that the fear was already there. Yeah. A lot of protocols were in place for going in buildings and things like that.
Yeah.
I think I thought at that point, you know, this is, we're on the cusp of something here. So that's the first question. So number two on my list, Hannah, and this is related to work. You've slogged away over the past few months producing a weekly report on all things COVID-19, travel and tourism here in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
So during that time, what things have encouraged you the most and what have discouraged you the most while you know, compiling those reports?
Yeah, I mean, my last 4 months of Sundays, I think, have been dedicated to reading stories about COVID-19. I would say what has encouraged me most is really the positive feedback that I've got. Every week I seem to get emails or LinkedIn messages from different people in different industries within the travel industry still, so whether they're hotels or investors or just travel bloggers reaching out to me and saying, hey, thanks, this is really useful. So that's great. I think the big struggle is, of course, reading that many articles every single week about the impact of COVID-19 on Southeast Asian tourism. You get to feel a little bit jaded after a while. I think I'm approaching 2,000 articles now on my dashboard, and then those are just the ones that I've found relevant. So there have been plenty of other ones that I've read that haven't quite made the cut. And it's no end in sight, right? That's what I'm going to be doing this Sunday.
Yeah. Certainly moving into August and still doing that every Sunday.
Yeah. So my second question for you, Gary, is as someone who works with hotel groups on strategic marketing and messaging, how easy has it been to change and redefine those long-held messages that they've been working on for years, really?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. It's a multi-layered question because as this pandemic, we know, as we said there, we're 7 months into this and the messaging has changed, for sure. You know, the initial messaging, as we go back to February, March, was, well, places closed, you know, hotels closed, they weren't doing any marketing.
Yeah.
There were no messages to get out. Now, some of the hotels that I work with are in Hong Kong and in China, and obviously they opened a little bit quicker, particularly for domestic market.
Yeah.
So the initial phase of marketing in China was basically, we went through that phase of actually well, do you have to be safe and secure and sanitized? Mm. But the hotel that I worked basically eschewed that right from the beginning.
Yeah.
It had done some research with its customers and its clients, and they actually had said right from the start, look, we expect these high standards of, of sanitation. Yeah. There's not much point promoting it.
Mm.
So then they really had to focus very much on how do we market to domestic travelers?
Yeah.
Obviously, China is a big market, but at that point, not many people were traveling interstate or interprovince.
Yep.
So they were mostly looking at promotions for the domestic market, the local market, which tended to focus on F&B and dining. Mm-hmm. They do have very good standards of F&B. They were commended by the Michelin stuff, the Michelin guide. So they have, you know, that to promote.
Yeah.
But it's been quite difficult as they come to summer because it's school holiday period now in, in China. So they're trying to promote to the Chinese market. So they're having to look at the obvious things, F&B, kids' activities, family activities, most of which is related to the hotel itself because they can't really sell too many tour packages in Beijing.
True.
So it's been quite difficult. But I have been impressed with the way that they've used quite ad hoc promotions. There was one they did quite recently. There's a very famous Taiwanese singer, Jay Cho, and he produced this song called Mojito, which is filmed in Cuba. It's very sort of aspirational, and it's also seen as an ode to love to his wife. So they focused on this, and they did a cocktail promotion around the mojito and the backstory of the mojito and the travel to Cuba. And it was nice. It was sort of like quite spontaneous, and it actually got great feedback. And I quite like that because it was very contemporary. It was choosing something that's in the moment.
Yeah.
And trying to eschew all the rest of the melee of COVID stuff that's around us. So those are the kinds of things, you know, I think hotel marketers have to be looking at right now is how can you find stories and, and curate content around things that are joyful.
Joyful is the key, isn't it? Right.
So on to number three, Hannah. So how has your tourism consultancy work evolved since the start of the campaign and where do you see it trending from here?
Another good question. So, I mean, as we were coming into the beginning of the year, I mean, I focus on two things, right? So I do a lot of sales repping throughout Southeast Asia, and then I also do this consulting with tourism boards. And obviously the sales representation side has gone down the toilet, really. I represent a European tour operator. No one's going to Europe. The shopping outlet in UK, London, definitely people are not going to London right now. So my focus has really shifted towards more understanding consumer behaviour post-COVID and working on projects with tourism boards to try and understand that, mainly by talking with the travel trade here to get their opinions, which are sometimes, as I was saying to Gary just before the podcast started, sometimes a little bit gloomy. Normally a little bit gloomy, very gloomy, but it's still very interesting actually to get that trade aspect because, you know, you and I, we kind of sit here in a not really ivory tower, but we're not quite so on the ground in the travel industry.
No one can actually right now.
So yeah, it's interesting to get the insights from people who are daily speaking to customers, whether those customers are simply asking for refunds or, you know, still potentially planning trips for next year.
Yeah.
So Gary, you work with market research companies looking at consumer, retail, branding and tech trades in Southeast Asia. Has that been a period of gloom like in travel or have other factors been in play?
A really good question. I would say it's been less gloomy, largely because you can consume from home.
Yes.
So obviously people are still looking to buy things. Obviously there is a bit of a downturn, but certainly the at-home shopping market has boomed.
Yeah.
And young creatives in particular have been trying to find ways to engage consumers that we haven't seen before. Now, a lot of this is related to COVID. So you're seeing a lot of like design work into things like sneakers and face masks and artworks and books and stuff that is related, but is sort of an upbeat version of what's happening in the, in the COVID situation. A lot of the work that I do in Vietnam is very, the consumer sector there is very vibrant and it's very youthful driven. So there are a lot of products, ideas, concepts that are coming out, which are, I don't know whether you'd say they wouldn't have happened before COVID, but they've certainly been accelerated. Now there's this feeling that we really need to revive the economy, we need to revive creativity, and that will be a part of the way the future economy will grow. So I think in terms of the positivity from the consumer sector is there, the technology sector as well. But, you know, a lot of these factors do feed back in somehow to the travel sector.
Yeah.
And that's not happening. So there is that blockage. But in terms of where consumer trends are going, particularly in countries like Vietnam, you know, there is definite positivity and a real buzz there, for sure.
That's
number four. What do you think have been some of the biggest impacts on the tourism industry in Southeast Asia over recent months, and which ones have been the most decisive?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to say I think the most decisive has to be closing borders, right? I mean, that. I think to a certain extent, you know, we were talking about this last week as well, it's how governments have changed the game. So from the game of just flattening the curve, but maybe travel would still be possible. You know, when you went in to all of these lockdowns, I don't think anybody ever expected it to last quite so long, into the, you know, chasing this zero cases. And as we've seen over the weekend, you know, Vietnam, which had no locally transmitted cases for, it was 99 days, so almost touched 100 days. Yep, now they've had 15 new locally transmitted cases and they don't know the source of it. And I think that shows even in Vietnam, it's still so, you know, it's so volatile still.
Yeah. Yeah, volatile is a good word. Resilience, the resilience of the virus and the volatility.
Yeah, so it's really just this new policy of pursuing zero cases. I think it just has such massive impact on the tourism industry. And at some point, they have to decide, do they reopen the economy? And some of these economies, maybe Vietnam can survive with borders closed, like we said, for a little bit longer, but others definitely will need to reopen soon. And until they do, we're just not going to see that bounce back in tourism.
Yeah, agree.
So, Gary, what country's response to COVID-19 in Southeast Asia has surprised you? In a good way.
In a good way. Well, I mean, you make the absolutely vital point there that, you know, the travel bans and the border closures have had such a decisive impact. Mm. You know, what's happened is we've taken away the supply and the demand factors from tourism.
Yeah.
And even though supply factors are starting to feed back in slowly, the expectation that demand will follow is very difficult.
Yeah.
So in terms of Southeast Asia, well, which countries have surprised me in a good way? Well, I mean, if you look at the balance of the structure of the numbers of cases, they're probably what you would expect. If you look globally, it's the biggest populations that are suffering the most. I think I looked on the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Center, and I think it's five of the top six countries in terms of total number of cases have populations of 100 million or more.
Yeah.
You look at our region, well, that's exactly the same. Indonesia and Philippines are the ones that struggled the most.
Yeah.
Singapore is probably the country that you'd say has surprised us the most because it just hasn't managed to contain. You know, the death rate and the active cases is very low, but it hasn't managed to contain.
Yeah.
So then you look at the bottom level and you look at countries like Laos, Cambodia, Brunei.
Yeah.
You know, they have done very, very well. Vietnam too.
Yeah.
But I think you have to look at Malaysia and Thailand. You know, relatively very travel industry-focused countries.
Yeah.
Thailand has a bigger population, but both of them struggled at the beginning. I think Thailand was the first country in our region that had a case.
Yeah.
Malaysia went into lockdown. I think it was the third highest number of cases in Asia, not just in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And the way they flattened those curve, both countries, I think, has been impressive.
Yeah.
Now, as we said million times on the pod before, the next stage is very, very difficult, and both countries seem to be struggling now with the next phase.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the populations of both countries should be quite proud of how the governments have managed that particularly difficult phase of flattening the curve. What happens next is very tricky.
Right, exactly.
So number five, moving on. So as someone who normally travels regularly for work, and as a mother of a young son, have you reflected on your own travel priorities in the near future and perhaps a little bit further ahead?
Good question. So I mean, like you, I would do a lot of regular traveling, typically for work. But now you definitely... I mean, I haven't been on even a domestic trip yet. It's also a little bit of a personal decision simply based on sleep because my son sleeps better at home, so I value the sleep over the holiday. But I mean, we are thinking about having a little domestic trip soon, but it will definitely be nearby. I don't think it will be one where we will take a flight there. Just because I think, and probably like many parents who've got young children, you feel very loath to expose them to any unnecessary risk, right? Yeah. So if you don't have to go, why would you? And I guess that is one of the things that's holding back the industry.
Yeah.
But even me myself, you know, I can see that that's a block to the industry recovering, but I still can't quite bring myself to think, oh, I'll take my son on a flight.
And I think that's very much also the phase that we're at right now in terms of the borders aren't open.
No.
We are seeing relatively low demand domestic travel. There's not still the same amount of flights availability. Just all that packaged together, as we said last week, you know, that increases the anxiety a little bit for everybody.
Yeah.
That's where we're at right now.
Yeah. So my turn, number six. What was your initial reaction to continuing to do a podcast about travel? when travel became impossible?
Well, I mean, that's a really difficult question. I mean, as we've said before on the podcast, you know, we actually started this podcast because we believed, I think justifiably, that Southeast Asia was and has been for a number of years the most dynamic region of travel and tourism in the world.
Yes.
And it may well be again. Yes. There are huge challenges to go forward. But obviously what's happened over the last 7 months is there has been so much to talk about. There are so many issues that have come to the fore about the structure, the nature, the operational aspects of tourism, which didn't get talked about before simply because we're in a boom time. And what has become clear is that obviously the tourism industry as a whole operates pretty well, pretty efficiently during boom times, but struggles when it gets difficult.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, this has been made more difficult by the input of governments closing borders and things like that. But there's been plenty to talk about, but none of it has been positive. So in terms of actually producing a podcast, you know, we have a lot of ideas. We talk to a lot of people. We get a lot of feedback all the time about what's actually happening on the ground. We can't actually get out there and see it so much at the moment. But I've never thought that we shouldn't continue with the podcast. You know, the feedback's been great, and that's really encouraging.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in terms of, it would be nice to talk about something different, wouldn't it?
Listen, let us know if you agree.
Yeah, so I'm going to ask you the same question. As you said, the podcast was forged in an era of next to no travel. I mean, do you think that has helped or hindered the show's development?
You know, in a way, I think it has helped us because I think we've had to be a little bit more creative, I think, in topics. So, you know, when we started out, we were thinking about doing these big kind of thematic ones. Maybe we would just focus on country by country, or we would focus on gastronomy or that kind of thing. But I think what we've quickly realised is actually COVID touches everything. You can't really do a podcast, let's say, just about Malaysia tourism in general, because we don't know where Malaysia tourism in general is going to go. You know, if we were doing this last year, it would be very linear, right? Okay, it's going to become more FIT, and these are the destinations that we think that they're going to go to. Now everything is up in the air.
Yeah.
And in a way, you know, they always say that, like, limitations kind of help boost creativity, and I think that's kind of the situation that we're in right now.
Yep.
We really have to find different angles and different ways of looking at the tourism industry.
Yeah. A lot of what we read, not just in media, but on social media sites, LinkedIn, you know, there's a lot of different opinions. There's a lot of debate going on, and that's good. And it's stimulating stuff that probably didn't happen otherwise.
Yes.
So people are really thinking about what happens going forward. But actually putting those plans or those ideas into process is we can't get there yet. And I think that's frustrating a lot of people. Understandably so.
So on to number seven. Gary, you've undertaken several interviews for our podcast so far. Which one did you enjoy the most?
Well, that's a tough question. I have to admit, I've always loved interviewing. Back into my journalistic days, I've always loved interviewing people. I've always loved trying to tease out ideas, get comments, get quotes, get insights. I've always loved doing that. And this time, obviously, I think I've done 4 or 5 interviews so far.
Yeah.
As we just said, you know, we're talking in a specific context right now. So everybody that we've interviewed, we are obviously aware that there is this backdrop that whatever we want to say, it is limited by the parameters that we're working within.
Yeah.
So I would say that all of them have been fine. It was great to speak to Stuart McDonald from Travel Fish. You know, he's very outspoken. He has great ideas. He is an inveterate traveler. He travels all the time. And he's, you know, he's cooped up right now. He can't get out. So some of that frustration you see on his social media.
Yeah.
We spoke to Nikki Scott, who's, you know, a backpacker by nature.
Yeah.
Obviously, she's seen that industry change so much, but at the moment, it's going nowhere. We spoke to Mac Patel from OAG, who gave some great insights about the aviation sector across the region.
Yeah.
And, you know, how it is so interconnected within the region itself, but also internationally. So that was an interesting. Maybe we'd like to revisit that because that was a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And then last week we spoke to Christy Almendorp, who she's done so many things, but she created her own luxury bespoke travel company, and she's just written a travel memoir.
Mm.
She's very thoughtful and thinks about things very, very deeply.
Mm.
And it's affected her as well in terms of how the mentality of travel right now may change going forward. So, and they're all very different aspects, very different angles. Yeah. I think the interesting thing for our podcast, we have these different formats and we want to do occasional interviews, but we're not necessarily an interview podcast. So we can bring in different ideas at times.
That was a very diplomatic answer.
It was, wasn't it?
No answer there.
So when you look back, we've done 30 pods now. When you look back over those podcasts that we produced, which ones stand out for you and why?
I think what some of the ones that really stand out for me is episode 2 and 3, where we did our 20 for the 2020s wish list, which was really one of the first proper podcasts that we put out. So we did a pilot one where we looked at 2019, and then we did one very much like this, where we were interviewing each other and finding out about each other's travel backgrounds. But I think where we really started to get the meat of things in Southeast Asia were those two. And I think it's just that optimism when you listen back to them now, you think, wow, it's really the level of optimism that I think
seems a long time ago.
Yeah, we're missing that now.
Yeah.
But I also really enjoyed our podcast last week about talking about fear. So that was episode 29, and how that's holding back. And I think probably our frustrations with the current situation probably came into that too. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of topics, but I think those would be my favourites. So question number 8. After all that's happened and given the current status, do you still believe Southeast Asia is the world's most dynamic tourism region, Gary?
Well, I just touched on that briefly, but I do. I do think that it has the ability to grow again strategically, because we are centred between these two huge dominant markets, India and China. Close proximity to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Investments coming in from Japan and Korea. Interest. The way that the world is changing at the moment, the United States seems to be having a greater role in Southeast Asia. We don't know whether American travelers will come back yet, but maybe in future. So the world is changing, but Southeast Asia does have this huge landmass, these huge populations, this huge appetite for travel within itself. You know, there's a great intra-regional market here, as well as the other factors that go around it. What happens going forward in future is obviously an unknown right now. But yeah, I do still think, if the industry can stay intact, if airlines can stay flying, that it has the possibility to be dynamic once again. I do.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I still believe there's such a big variety in tourism products here. There's still this growing population, which is going to drive outbound tourism. And yes, you know, most of the economies right now are all suffering, but they are all still forecast to bounce back next year. You know, in terms of outbound travel from Southeast Asia, of course, there's going to be this massive drop right now, but I do think that it will pick up, and it will still pick up fairly fast, because, you know, travel is still an aspirational thing. So I think a lot of younger travelers still want to go abroad, and that's not going to stop happening. And I think in terms of what's going on domestically, then I think that there will be a lot of interesting new products to come out as well.
Yeah. I think one of the caveats I would add is that, you know, we've seen in recent weeks, Singapore last week, you know, is a good case of that, of this move to try and supplant some of the outbound movements with domestic tourism. So, you know, replacing demand in the local economy that would have otherwise travelled outside. And obviously we know that's not going to last forever.
Yep. But
one of my worries going forward as the recovery starts to begin is business travel. You know, I don't see business travel rebounding as fast as leisure travel. And so there's going to be a big gap to fill there. So we're going to have to hope that there's going to be more leisure travel to fill that void. And I just don't know in the near future whether that's going to be possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely sending kind of incentives abroad is something that companies are really going to be thinking about, liability, and whether that's something that they want to risk. You know, even if you're sending, say you send 50 of your staff off on a company holiday, one of them somehow catches COVID and then they all catch COVID, that's your whole, you know, if you sent your management team, that's your whole management team out.
Yeah.
You know, just from that point of view.
Yeah, and I think the other turnaround that the industry will have to confront is that trips will be shorter. You know, I don't think people will be taking the longer multi-destination trips for a while. I think it will take a while for that to come back.
Yeah.
So I think the industry is going to have to work out how it can maximize the opportunities of short stay travel. Okay, so on that basis, we just touched on that, Hannah. A lot of talk at the moment is focusing on the likely regionalization of travel, especially with the uncertainty over long-haul flying. Now, that's not just here in Asia, that's in Europe, that's in Americas. You know, we're looking at that as a global phenomenon. So do you see Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia, and South Asia becoming even more integrated in travel terms as a result of COVID-19?
I'm not sure, actually. I think with the situation that the airlines are going through right now, a lot of routes are inevitably going to be cut, you know, for cost-cutting initiatives. And I'm not sure whether airlines will still see the value in keeping all of these routes, at least in the short run, you know. But I think, of course, in the medium run, the long run, they will want to get those back. But I think in the short run, they will just be looking at just integrating themselves around the region. So I think that we might see, even perhaps less connectivity between these different regions, or at least regions that are seen as more dangerous than others. So for example, South Asia, perhaps they might not see, you know, in Southeast Asia, South Asia perhaps is seen as a slightly more dangerous region than Northeast Asia. So perhaps airlines will decide we can cut routes there. So certainly I don't think there's going to be a greater integration than we see now. How about you?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point, because it really does rely on the airlines. You're absolutely right. And they're the ones that at the moment are right in the face of this crisis. We don't quite know who's going to come out of this. And as you say, route networks will definitely be closed. Whatever happens, airlines will be slimmer. They will have less resources, and they'll be flying less frequency. So that's absolutely important. I mean, it comes back to the absolute economics of this. You know, I agree with you that South Asia at the moment doesn't look as an opportunity to fly there. But, you know, the Indian outbound market is quite important to our region. The cases are growing incredibly fast. And I think I saw a survey the other day where a lot of people in India saying they're not expecting to travel internationally, certainly this year, and maybe the beginning of next year as well. So there is a reality factor. Everybody in this region wants the Chinese market back. Everybody in this region is going to want the Japanese and the Korean markets back. The Taiwanese market is very important as well. So, you know, the inevitable reset will still look at these markets. I do wonder what's going to happen in terms of outbound, you know, particularly like the further destinations, even like Sydney, Melbourne, even New Zealand.
Yeah.
That's a, what, five-hour flight, six-hour flights?
New Zealand longer than that, yeah.
That's tricky at the moment. Perth is obviously a lot closer to the region. But in terms of, will it become more regionalized? Well, I think you're seeing that in Europe at the moment. You know, the only option for Europe to open really was, it has the Schengen agreement, so you can travel within borders, but it doesn't look as though it's a huge success. You know, some countries are reporting spike. Our region will inevitably have to look in upon itself. I don't really see there's going to be any other option.
Yes.
And so the 10th and final question, Hannah. We've touched on some of these, but you know, what do you see on the broader view? What do you see as the biggest challenges and opportunities for travel and tourism in Southeast Asia for the rest of this year? Okay. So from August through December.
Okay, the biggest challenge has to be survival.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? Right. At that most basic level, it's just surviving. It's having, getting that cash flow from somewhere and just lasting it out, basically, until we turn a corner and either governments start to change their policies, a vaccine is found, a medicine that's used to treat COVID-19 better has been found. It's just to survive. But in terms of opportunities, I mean, I think it's just this opportunity to pivot and to look at domestic tourism. You know, I'm not going to take the really naive view of this is great. You know, domestic tourism is so great. It's going to give everyone a chance to change. But what I think it does have is that opportunity to test out new products for the inbound market. So what Singapore has done last week, they launched their $33 million campaign, Singapore Rediscovers. And part of that is that they want to develop new domestic products, but not only for the domestic market, but they are also thinking that when the inbound market later on picks up, they'll be able to transfer those same products across. So I think it's the opportunity now for companies to be relooking at inbound and domestic tourism and what new products there can be, not only for just the domestic market, but, you know, the longer term potential of creating new products for tourists coming in. How about you? What do you think?
Well, absolutely. Survival is absolutely the key. Domestic, I think we said this on the pod a few episodes ago, you know, you can use domestic tourism not just as a buffer, not just as a way of keeping people traveling, keeping economies moving, but you can use it in a positive way. I mean, I think you're absolutely right there in terms of creating these new products. We said that we could actually look at the data flows of how people are actually traveling at this point and how that could be interpreted to help you know, sell inbound travel in future. There is also this idea that you can use the marketing from domestic travel through the sharing of social media at new venues and new destinations, that kind of thing. You can use that. So there is a positive aspect there. I think a lot of it does come down to products and marketing. I think this is an opportunity to actually rethink the way that you actually promote your own country, your own destinations, your own hotels, because, as you say, survival will rely on that. The innovation is going to be absolutely essential. We don't yet know when borders will open. I mean, it's very hard to make guesstimations, but it doesn't at the moment look as though it's going to be this year here in Malaysia.
It's not looking good.
It's not looking good.
I still think it will open to Southeast Asia.
Do you think it will?
I'm going to try and stay positive.
I think a lot of this is going to be benchmarked on Bali. So Bali is opening up on September the 11th. Mm. Let's see what happens there. I don't think anywhere else will open before that.
No. No, Vietnam was starting to have talks, but of course now it's got these 15 cases and it's gone back into partial lockdown and things. So I don't think we'll see much movement.
But then again, I do wonder also whether the reopening will not be the reopening that we were expecting. You know, will the reopening be just sort of test cases? We've said this before. Will it just be a few islands that are opened up? Will it be charter flights to begin with? Will there be a way of actually sort of easing this in very gradually so that, you know, not everybody's traveling at the same time? Yeah. Bali doesn't seem to be doing that yet. But I mean, I do wonder whether we're looking at travel and tourism as we always have done in terms of inbound and outbound markets as a country.
Yeah.
And actually, we have to look at it more regionally and more locally in future.
Yeah, I mean, and actually, that's what Malaysia and Thailand have started to do each when they are thinking about. They've moved away now from thinking about travel bubbles with an entire country to thinking about travel bubbles with a green zone.
Yeah.
So more of a regional approach, which I think has some merit. But of course, as you know, I think we keep saying, then there's nothing to prevent those regions mixing with other regions. So it is still complicated, but perhaps it is a more feasible idea than waiting for an entire country to go green.
So, Hannah, that brings us almost to the end of this week's 30th edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. One more quick question. Give me just a one-word answer. Where would you first travel to when the borders reopen?
Maldives. What about you?
Sri Lanka. That's two words.
Yeah, cheats.
So we hope you enjoyed the show. And as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts and your insights on the challenges ahead in 2020 for the travel sector. So please contact us by email at hello@seasiatravelshow.com, via our Facebook page, the SEA Travel Show, or on Twitter, SEA Travel Show.
And keep your comments coming on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show. And of course, you can catch up with all 29 previous episodes on the website, the seasiatravelshow.com, and both Spotify and Google Podcasts. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on either platform.
Yeah, and now we're also on the Pocket Cast and Podchaser platforms, and there are more coming soon.
Right, well, that's a wrap for this week's podcast. We're both off to start work on the Friday Rewind show, so look out for that later in the week. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.
Yeah, bye-bye.